Next month marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Many Americans remain fascinated with the circumstances surrounding his murder and the investigation, the politics and personalities of his era, and the influence of his brief presidency on later administrations. Larry Sabato, professor of politics and director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, is the author of a new book titled The Kennedy Half-Century, The Presidency, Assassination, and Lasting Legacy of John F. Kennedy, and it's the basis of a public television documentary. Larry Sabato joins us now. Welcome.
Good morning.
Before asking you about the book and the documentary, I want to ask you to gaze into your crystal ball just 2 weeks before Virginia's election for governor. And give us your prediction. Is Democrat Terry McAuliffe's lead over Republican Ken Cuccinelli going to hold up?
Probably. I have a website at the University of Virginia Center for Politics called The Crystal Ball, and we're in the business of prognosticating about elections and projecting them. We were actually the first rating service in the country to project in August that Terry McAuliffe was likely to win the election. And I don't think anything much has changed except his margin has expanded. Ken Cuccinelli has his own problems. That is, I think he has overemphasized social issues, and he doesn't represent the more moderate Virginia of today. But he's also had some rotten luck that has made it very difficult for him to win. First, there's the Libertarian candidate. Structurally, this race is tilted toward a Democrat because the Libertarian's getting about 10%, and disproportionately that comes from Republicans. Then there's Governor McDonald's giftgate. A year ago, Governor McDonald was enormously popular. He could have pulled Cuccinelli in on his coattail simply by doing what Virginia governors who are popular normally do, which is go out and say, here's my successor, please elect him. You know, it's been since the 1880s that Virginia has given a party just one term in the governor's mansion, so this is extraordinary. And then I think finally the government shutdown has probably put the icing on the cake for McAuliffe. People seem to be blaming the Republicans disproportionately. You can say that's fair, you can say it's unfair, but those are the facts, and that has also punished Cuccinelli. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? The Tea Party Republican caucus engineered the government shutdown, and their first political victim is the Tea Party candidate for governor of Virginia.
Now about the book, The Kennedy Half-Century. First, let me ask you about a bit of news that's already made. Your research disproved a theory endorsed by a House of Representatives committee 16 years after the assassination that a fourth bullet was fired that day in Dallas and that the sound of that shot was captured by a police officer's radio.
Yes, the last thing the study of the Kennedy assassination needs is another theory. I cataloged more than 100 of them, literally 100 different theories about what happened that day in Dallas. So I decided to try and eliminate a big one. There have been two commissions designed to study the Kennedy assassination from the government perspective. The first was the Warren Commission. I am extremely critical of the Warren Commission, and I give a couple of dozen reasons why they were so inadequate and their process was so bad. By the way, it doesn't mean their conclusions were wrong, but it was a deceptive process. They were lied to by the CIA, by the FBI, by Lyndon Johnson, but they also had their own faults. And they produced a report that was so inadequate that it has literally condemned the country to 50 years of cynicism. So I'm very critical of the Warren Commission. But that's been studied to death. The one that hasn't been studied was the second commission, the one in the 1970s, the House Select Committee on Assassinations. After 3 years of study, they concluded, quote, President Kennedy was probably killed as the result of a conspiracy. How did they reach that conclusion? They relied on a police recording on a so-called dicta belt at police headquarters that was recorded at the very moment of the assassination in Dealey Plaza because a microphone on the motorcycle of one of the cops riding in the motorcade had stuck. And this old device had supposedly recorded these impressions of gunfire. Their sound analysis in the 1970s said that there were four shots within a short time span in Dealey Plaza everyone on all sides of the controversy agrees that Lee Harvey Oswald had time to fire only 3 shots. So 4 shots equals a conspiracy. And they said that their evidence was valid up to 95%. They were 95% sure that it was accurate. Well, I went out and hired the very best sound analysts in the world. They do a lot of the Pentagon's work and super secret submarine stuff and so on. They know their field. And I learned more about acoustical analysis than I ever thought I was going to in life. We worked with them for over a year, having gotten the dicta belts out of the National Archives, and their whole series of them. We were able to perform an elaborate series of tests, and we've proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, because we've consulted other people about it, beyond a shadow of a doubt, it turns out there was no gunfire on that dicta belt, and the policeman with the stuck microphone was 2.5 miles away, waiting for President Kennedy at the Trademark, where he was to deliver a luncheon speech that sadly he was never able to give. It was impossible to record the sound of gunfire on this tiny little microphone with the power of a telephone receiver 2.5 miles away from Dealey Plaza. So long and short, we blew up the report of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and as far as their assertion of conspiracy, it no longer exists. And once people read the book, they will understand why. Now, if I could add one thing, the dicta belts are not useless. They actually extend, the recordings extend from 9:30 in the morning approximately to 3:30 in the afternoon on that terrible day in Dallas, November 22nd, 1963. They're a time tunnel. They're a kind of living history, or as I like to say, they're a black box that recorded the disaster that occurred in Dallas. We have now put all these together. We've enhanced the sound. We've produced a 30,000-word transcript, and we're producing an app that will be available to everyone very shortly. So they can literally go through the day and hear what is happening from the police perspective. It's fascinating.
We're talking to Larry Sabato, author of The Kennedy Half Century. One of the most enduring questions people still have about John Kennedy is whether the Vietnam War would have been expanded so massively if JFK had lived and been elected to a second term.
Well, everyone has an opinion, and all I can tell you is I've well researched it. Yep. And my conclusion is, while you can't be 100% sure, I think it's highly unlikely that President Kennedy would have committed 535,000 troops thousands of miles away. Why? President Kennedy was extraordinarily cautious. He was by nature. And while he had a wild private life, his public life was built on incremental change. He was also, in essence, a conservative, and you can see that in his foreign policy. You can see it in his economic policy and domestic policies. Johnson was exactly the opposite. It was, you know, throw everything but the kitchen sink at whatever problem he was focusing on. I think we would have stayed involved in Vietnam, but we would not have been involved anywhere near to the extent that Johnson committed us. And, of course, that ruined us in many respects, economically and in our foreign policy.
Well, what about the historic legislation that passed under Lyndon Johnson, civil rights, voting rights, Medicare? Would it have passed as easily in a second Kennedy administration?
Here's what was likely to happen, underline likely. You never know, was some of Kennedy's extramarital affairs going to come out in the public and change everything. But let's assume that didn't happen. He would have been reelected handily in 1964 against Barry Goldwater, who was going to be the Republican nominee regardless, but not nearly by the margin that Johnson won by. Johnson got 61%. I think Kennedy would have gotten 54, 55%. So he wouldn't have had the same cushion of additional Democratic representatives in the House and Senate. I do believe the Civil Rights Act would have passed, but it wouldn't have passed until after his reelection. It was passed as a tribute to President Kennedy in the summer of 1964. I don't know about the Voting Rights Act. I'm not even sure that Kennedy would have pushed for it. He certainly wouldn't have pushed, I believe, for the open housing law that passed in 1968. He certainly wouldn't have pushed for the war on poverty. Just before going to Dallas, Kennedy had reluctantly approved a couple of pilot programs in a few cities and counties. He saw that as a waste of money, potentially. Johnson was told about Kennedy's decision the day after the assassination. He countermanded it and said, "That's my kind of program. Go all in. Go full tilt." And that's how the war on poverty began. You see the difference between Johnson and Kennedy?
Yes. Well, you're right about the different ways that later presidents invoked Kennedy's legacy, some greatly, some hardly at all. Perhaps surprisingly to some, Republican icon Ronald Reagan often found similarities and parallels with JFK.
Of all the nine presidents that I studied in terms of the Kennedy's legacy, I was most impressed with Ronald Reagan. His use of Kennedy was shrewd. He had two big things he wanted to get done. He wanted to drive the communists out of business, which to some degree, along with all the other presidents who had fought communism, he was able to do. Who did he quote? In every speech, it was John F. Kennedy, whose rhetoric was Cold War. Just go back to Kennedy's inaugural address in 1961 if you don't believe me. So Kennedy was undergirding Reagan's foreign policy. And then what was Reagan's number one domestic priority? That big across-the-board tax cut. Who had engineered the last big across-the-board tax cut? John F. Kennedy. So in every speech, including national TV addresses, Reagan quoted Kennedy. He also did something very shrewd privately that people never saw at the time. He cultivated the Kennedys. Remember, the Kennedys hated Jimmy Carter. Ted Kennedy had run against Jimmy Carter. Privately, even though they were Democrats, they were thrilled that Reagan beat Carter. Reagan knew it. He had the Kennedys in. I think they were in the White House under Reagan more than they had been since JFK left office, literally. They were in there all the time for one occasion or another. Reagan helped them raise a lot of money for the JFK Library and Museum up in Boston. This cemented the relationship. He even got a note from John F. Kennedy Jr. saying to Reagan, "Don't listen to any criticism about quoting my father. I'm giving you this note with full permission to quote him all you want."
Perhaps no president has made more effort to inherit the Kennedy mantle than Bill Clinton. Now, he idolized President Kennedy from the day he met him as a teenager in the White House Rose Garden, right?
I don't think we've ever before had a president who so idolized a former president, with the exception, of course, of John Quincy Adams, whose father John Adams had served, and then eventually George W. Bush, although he acted more like Reagan than his father, George H.W. Bush. But the Clinton-Kennedy connection was talked about at every turn, and Clinton used Kennedy, obviously, during the election of 1992 to suggest that he was another JFK. Well, I'm a little critical of that. I don't believe that that he was. He certainly, rhetorically, was not another JFK. As we always used to say, Clinton was articulate, but not especially inspiring. Also, his policies were very different from John F. Kennedy. Bill Clinton, even though he was a relatively moderate Democrat for the 1990s, was clearly to the left of where JFK was in the early 60s. So I actually saw more policy implications in what Reagan did than in what Clinton did.
The book is The Kennedy Half Century, which went on sale this month and has been made into a documentary produced by WCVE Public Television by Paul Roberts in collaboration with the university's Center for Politics. And that documentary will premiere November 4th at 9 p.m. on WCVE Richmond PBS and WHTJ in Charlottesville, and will be seen around the country on PBS stations and abroad. Larry Sabato, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.